Welcome to Refirement Life, the podcast for anyone navigating life transitions or planning to make life transitions to ensure your next years are your best years. Listen in for insightful, generous, and sometimes humorous conversation. It's time to get fired up with Christine Zamuda and Muge Wood, your hosts for this latest episode of Refirement Life.
Today we're doing something a little different and very special. I'm joined by an award-winning journalist whose remarkable career spans over 30 years. She's interviewed five living U.S. presidents and covered powerful stories of resilience from all around the globe. With so much wisdom and experience to share, I was fortunate to sit down with Suzanne Malveaux, not for just one, but two podcast sessions. I truly hope you enjoy listening and learning as much as I did. Let's get into part one.
All right. Hello.
Hi.
And welcome to Refirement Life. I am here today with a friend and award-winning journalist, speaker, and advocate, the very talented Suzanne Malveaux. I want to tell you a little bit about Suzanne before we get started. Suzanne had the great privilege of covering five living presidents in her career as a CNN journalist. She also was embedded with the U.S. troops in 2011 for the 10th anniversary of 9/11, where she led breaking news coverage of the Taliban's terrorist attack on the U.S. Embassy. In September 2005, Malveaux returned to her family's hometown of New Orleans, where she reported on the devastation and recovery following Hurricane Katrina. She was part of the coverage team that earned the CNN Peabody Award for its Katrina reporting and a DuPont Award for CNN's coverage of the tsunami disaster in Southeast Asia. Today, Suzanne serves as the co-chair of the board of directors for the International Women's Media Foundation. She is a brilliant keynote speaker and is just involved in so many projects and storytelling that it's just going to be such a treat for our listeners to spend some time with Suzanne. It's a great privilege to have you here today.
Thank you.
Welcome.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you. I know we've been meaning to get together for a while.
I know. Here we are. All right. Well, let's get started. So, wow. You've had such a long career, both at NBC and CNN, over 30 years. How did you first break into the business and land here in Washington?
Well, you might not believe this, but I was pre-med. I was going to be a doctor at first. My father wanted one of us to be a doctor, but I was interning in college back in the day at internships at radio and TV stations. So when I realized that was a place that I could actually make a career of, I got really excited and thought about journalism. But early on, one of the things when I first started was you had the creation of these national cable stations. So CNN, right? That was like my dream job, if I could be a part of CNN's team and Ted Turner. And so I had studied a lot about that. But when I broke into the business, it went from these national, international stations, networks to regional cable stations. So there was a brand new one that was popping up in Boston, in the Boston area, New England Cable News. And so shortly after my education, that was the place that I landed, was New England Cable News. It was in the Boston area, and I really wanted to go back home. Mm-hmm. So the DC area is home, but also that's where all the action is, right? So you have the embassies, the White House, Capitol Hill, the Pentagon, everything. So I knew that ultimately I wanted to get back to Washington or in the Washington market, which is top 10. So if you take, you know, a whole bunch of markets in the country, the top 10 is really where you want to land because that's where all the excitement is, right?
Right.
And so I was in Boston at New England Cable News. And basically I was doing blizzards, I was doing floods, I was
reporting
doing,
you know,
the lobsters, you know, like all kinds of things. Now, I'm not going to, you know, badmouth Boston or anything. It's a great new city.
Yeah, great city.
But I, you know, I was breaking into the business. So I was earning my stripes and I think I was making like $18,000 when I first started and just working constantly all the time, 24/7.
In Boston too.
I can tell you how I was living in Cambridge. It was quite meager. but I was at New England Cable News and I wanted to get back home, wanted to get in, cut into the market. So I took my vacations, right? You have like a week vacation every year. So I took my vacations and what I would do is I made these tapes, and this dates me because these are VHS tapes we're talking about, right? Uh-huh. You know, for the audience, well, your audience knows and understands.
Of course we do.
I don't have to explain. VHS tapes. So I made my tapes.
It's a Blockbuster. We're the cool kids.
That's right. and so I would make my tapes of the best of, right, that I was doing at New England Cable News. And I cold called all of the news directors in Washington, D.C., and all of the news directors in Baltimore. And I introduced myself over the phone, and I said, I'm Suzanne Malveaux, and I would like to break into the market, and I have a tape. Would you take a look at my tape? Right. Just 10 minutes. Will you give me 10 minutes of your time? And believe it or not, right, 10 minutes is not a lot of time. So nobody said no to me.
Oh,
it was kind
awesome.
Of amazing, right? Like, I don't know why I had the chutzpah to, like, just do that. But I wanted it.
Yeah.
So they all said yes. Mm-hmm. And so I hit all of the newsrooms in Baltimore and Washington. And they were great because nobody – I mean, they it was just about an hour they would give me of their time because you're asking people for their advice and their opinion, and they feel very good about like, oh, you know, let me help you. Mm-hmm. Let me show you what you're doing right, what you're doing wrong. And so I was green. I was very green. So they didn't, you know, they were like, okay, you need to stop doing this. You need to stand up straight, you know, fix your posture, change this, work on that. So, and most of them would just say, we don't have openings, right? Uh-huh. We don't have a job. But here's what you need to do. Come back.
That's awesome.
Come back.
And you needed your own traveling masterclass. Best.
I didn't even realize what I was doing. And so I did that for a while and I was kind of tired of doing it because I wasn't really getting very far, but I was getting good advice. And I took a vacation with my sister. I have a twin sister and we took our vacation to Miami. And when I went to Miami, I did the same thing. I had my tape in my suitcase in between the, you know, the sunbathing lotion and the bathing suit. So I called the NBC affiliate and I said, I'm in town. You know, will you see me? I met with the news director and I got a job on the spot.
Wow.
Got an offer on the spot. I was like, what? And then the beauty of it was, I was like, I was so, so happy and so excited. The beauty of it was, is the next day I got a call from Channel 4 in D.C., and they had an opening and an offer.
Whoa.
And at that point, I was like, what the hell is happening to my life? It was wonderful because then I had two options. I played them off of each other so that I could get the best salary and the best experience, the best contract. And I said yes to Channel 4. And that's how I ended up in Washington. That's how I made it to Washington.
You're really self-made.
I can't believe, you know, it's like, I still have some of those tapes, by the way. So if you have a VHS player.
I have one.
Okay.
I have one.
They're kind of hilarious.
We're watching.
Very big hair. Big hair situation
shoulder pads,
going on.
Probably.
Yes. The whole thing. Very little makeup. But fast forward, when I was at Channel 4 for 3 years doing local news, The beauty of being there was that on the first floor was the network, NBC Network National, and on the second floor, the top floor, was local news. Mm-hmm. So that's where we were based. So I would pass every day and I'd walk down that hall, NBC Network News, and I'd see the big photos of like the greats, Gwen Ifill and Jim Mikuláševsky and Bob Hager. Mm-hmm. Like their pictures were huge, larger than life on the wall.
Right.
And I was like, one day,
yes.
Maybe that'll be me. And so I did a lot of...
I'm surprised you didn't have a poster in your suitcase just to like, here you go.
Well, I didn't put a mustache on anybody. So I guess I was a good sport about the whole thing, right? But I ended up, you know, again, that first week I was very nervous. I was in the editorial meeting with Jim Vance, who was one of my local heroes, right? The late Jim Vance, scared out of my mind because I'm like, what the hell am I doing here in the same room with Jim Vance? I couldn't even speak. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of like a fatherly figure, but cooler, totally. Much cooler.
Totally.
And whenever I was on the set with him, I was always like just very nervous. Mm-hmm. And he would be like, girl, calm down. Girl, calm down. You know, like, get yourself together, right?
Right.
So eventually I ended up being the lead. I would do the lead story for the 6 and the 11 in the evenings. Yeah. And that's where all of the viewers were, really. That was kind of like the prime time spot. Mm-hmm. And so I caught the eye of the late Tim Russert, and it was just amazing because he approached me after my contract was over, mm-hmm. my local contract of 3 years, mm-hmm. and said, hey, you know, we're doing this thing over here on the network level. We're breaking through and starting this cable thing. You know, wonder if you'd be interested. And I was like, oh yeah, you know, like network. And it was, you know, an opportunity to get out of local news and doing all the, you know, a lot of the crime, which was really kind of difficult to handle at times. And so he said, yeah, it's this thing, you know, MSNBC.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just starting. And so myself and Chip Reed were hired for MSNBC. And it was amazing because I mean, we had all of Washington to play with.
Right.
Like it, so it was boots on the ground, trial by fire, threw me into the White House, threw me into the Pentagon, threw me on Capitol Hill. Everything that was going on in DC, they so, just, you know,
so
it was just learning
back then, like,
as you go.
What was going on in the White House in those years that you covered?
Well, I jumped into the Bill Clinton White House, and the big story at that time was the Monica Lewinsky and the impeachment scandal.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and so that was one of the major stories that I did. And the Star Report, if you can believe it, I remember getting the Star Report, and literally it looks like kind of like telephone books, old telephone books or encyclopedias, you know, like maybe about 4 inches, 3 to 4 inches thick though. And there were four of them.
Wow.
And, you know, there were physical hard copies that they handed to each one of us, mm-hmm. the Star Report, which kind of explained the whole case that they were laying out against the president. And I just remember taking these four very, very large books home with me and sitting in a Chinese restaurant, eating my food and trying to digest what it was that I had just received.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of that story.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for the listeners out there, it's not just someone talking into your ear about what to say. There's a lot that goes with journalism and doing the job.
It's kind of amazing because I get that a lot. Mm-hmm. Like people do think that you're just reading a script or people are, you know, speaking to you about mm-hmm. what you need to say. But by the time you get to the White House, you really do have a lot of editorial control because mm-hmm. there is nobody who is actually going to be policing you at the time mm-hmm. when you're doing your live shots. I mean, mm-hmm. by the time you get there, there's a lot of preparation that mm-hmm. you've gone through and a lot of trust that the network has, because I will tell you, over the course of several administrations, it's not uncommon to get a call from the White House, from the administration, calling your boss, telling them they didn't like this story. And that goes for Democrats and Republicans alike, right? And so your boss has to have confidence in you mm-hmm. that you're standing with your sources and you are telling the truth and you have, you know, the facts to back it up.
Right.
And so that, you know, from time to time, you know, of course, the White House, they want the most favorable stories that they can have, and they don't always get that. And so, you know, you're doing your job well if you're getting complaints from both sides.
Right.
You know, you're playing it straight.
Yeah. That's a good bellwether, actually, to think about.
Yeah.
So Tim Russert was a mentor and really seemed to help you in your career, huh?
He was. Yeah. And he historically would pluck local reporters out and recruit them to mm-hmm. the network if he felt like they were people who, you know, had that interests and that ability. So it, you know, it was Gwen Ifill, it was Soledad O'Brien, it was Joe Johns, it was Katie Couric, like a whole bunch of us kind of had that path.
Wow, he had an eye for talent.
Through the late Tim Russert, which was really, I mean, it was so fortunate.
I used to see him quite a bit at, on the 4500 block of Wisconsin was where the old Microsoft office was. And he would be out in front smoking a cigarette.
Well, I wasn't out there smoking with
him. No, I never saw him with you.
But we were based right off of Nebraska, so it was pretty close.
Yeah, right there. Oh, wow. So, you know, speaking of the early days, so, you know, as a trailblazer and one of the first Black women to solo anchor a CNN weekday show, what was that experience like? What lessons did you learn? Take us back in time.
Well, one of the things about breaking a barrier is you really have to work hard at it, you know, before it happens. And so I was Wolf Blitzer's primary substitute for his show, The Situation Room, for 2 years before I got that break. And so there's a definitely a sense of proving yourself over and over and over again. One of the first times that I anchored in Wolf's place, it was the first time actually, and we had a sheets of paper, rundown, and very specific about all the different stories, and we were practicing it and all of that, and so I felt ready, and so I was sitting in the chair, I was ready, felt ready. And I would say, and I'm not exaggerating, maybe it was 7 minutes, maybe it was five, it was likely 7 minutes before the newscast, breaking news, Deep Throat. The identity of Deep Throat had been revealed, breaking news. And so everybody, they tore up the rundown. There was no rundown at all. So it was like, here we go. Trial by fire.
You're on the wire without a net.
And I was like, holy crap. So, of course, so my producer, Sam Feist, he's excellent. So he knew what we were doing. He knew the situation, right? And he was like, okay, Suzanne, all right, here's what we're going to do, right? We're going to give you guests, and you're just going to keep tossing to guests, experts, right? And cold calls, they were calling the bookers. This is where you get your bookers involved. You know, give us a historian, give us somebody in the Nixon administration, give us an author, like just start lining up guests. They're on the phone. This person will be coming in person. Here are the bullet points and let's go. Right. And so there's a lot of ad-libbing.
Oh yeah.
There is some assistance, you know, cause you have to have a good director in your ear who is calm and experienced, not somebody who's yelling and getting, kind of nervous and crazy, which is wonderful. You want a calm, experienced person in your ear. You want the notes to keep coming constantly, right? This is the breaking news mode that you're in. And Sam, he had some little figurine, some little superhero figurine, rubber little thing that guys have, I guess. And he put it on the desk and he's like, good luck. And he had like this little superhero thing. And I'm like, okay, is this supposed to help me? I don't know, but whoever you are, you know, your little caped guy is supposed to help. And I keep that. I've kept that little superhero figurine. But I had that on the desk, and then we just went for it. And it was an amazing hour. It worked, but it was really just like nothing I had ever experienced before.
Oh, yeah.
And that is what you have to do over and over again, right? Before you break that barrier.
Yes.
Right. And so breaking that barrier was significant in many ways. My parents and, my community, very, very proud. And my parents always instilled in me the sense of like, you are doing this for many people. It's not just for yourself. You're representing a lot of people. Right. And my parents grew up in the segregated South. And so they both went through the Jim Crow era and they always explained their lives to us as we were kids growing up, not to scare us, but to actually help us appreciate, right, where we were in society and how far we had come. And so, they grew up in an era where there was, colored only, they couldn't go to the neighborhood school or the neighborhood church, or the neighborhood swimming pool. And they had to use the back entrance entrance of the hospital to get care.
Right.
Like that was their lives.
Wow.
And my grandparents, three out of four of my grandparents, didn't have an education beyond elementary school. Mm-hmm. They had to work on the farms. They had to support their families. Mm-hmm. And so I had a sense of responsibility, mm-hmm. and I felt like, damn, they'd be proud. You know, like mm-hmm. they, who could imagine, right? Oh, right. You know, by the way, you know, your grandchild is going to be, you know, on CNN anchoring a show or standing in front of the White House. Yeah. Right. And yeah. so it does give you a sense of, yes, accountability and responsibility.
Right.
To, and it's sometimes, you know, when I felt like I needed that extra boost or mm-hmm. that help in my confidence, I kind of conjure up their memories and be like, okay, all right, that. Here I'm going.
I love that.
You know, a little prayer here. All right, guys, you know, so you don't feel so alone.
Right? Yes.
Because one of the other things that you experience is, we used to tell jokes, you know, laugh about it, but mm-hmm. there's usually one of every position. You know, there's the black anchor, there's the black photographer, there's the black producer or the black mm-hmm. executive or the black booker. There's usually just one, right? And it's gotten better, mm-hmm. obviously, right? But that the exception is on the weekends when it seems like we're all there, right? We all get the weekend. But we used to be like, is this BET over here or what?
You know? The blackout.
and so it was like, you know, that was interesting.
Yeah.
But one thing that happened that was really unique uh-huh. was I was on the weekend shift and I did MSNBC, mm-hmm. MSNBC during the week for the White House and some other beats. But I did the weekend national, the network news.
Okay.
And that's kind of how the hierarchy goes, mm-hmm. right? You cut your teeth and cable, and then you go to the weekend, and then you get weekday. uh-huh. And so,
time and
yes, exactly, right? Exactly. That's how it goes. And for me, there was one weekend nightly news mm-hmm. where Soledad O'Brien was anchoring. So she was in the anchor chair, and she started the newscast, and then she tossed to me, mm-hmm. and I did my live shot from the White House. I did my report, and then she tossed to Sharon Epperson, who is a CNBC reporter. Mm-hmm. So she did her financial report, and then they tossed to Roz Jordan, who was the national correspondent. So we had that whole newscast. At the end of the newscast, we were like, what the hell just happened? It was four black females uh-huh. back to back to back, and we're all Harvard grads.
Wow.
And it was like, did the world just like completely explode? Like, what was that?
Right.
It was so much fun. It was interesting, right?
Yeah.
Because I was like, well, okay.
What sisterhood there, right?
Yeah. And then the, you know, barriers that are broken mm-hmm. and celebrating that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine. I do imagine just knowing how things were in tech and corporations coming up, but to be on camera and to have that next level of scrutiny and competition, I mean, breaking those barriers is really significant. I mean, it's just something obviously you're proud of and should be.
I think my family is proud and the community is proud mm-hmm. and one of the things that you just kind of focus on is that you always just have to do the job and do it well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's great when you acknowledge you've broken the barrier and then you just put your head down and do the work.
Right.
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 And that's, I think, what makes the difference is that you prove that you are very much, you know, in the, as my mom said, running with the big dogs.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yes, you were. All right. Well, let's go to some of the moments where you're actually doing the job. And I mean, you just gave us a glimpse of what it was like to handle something in real time, being brand new. You know, is there other stories that come to mind when you were kind of like doing something that was a little outrageous or maybe unscripted?
I will say there are a couple of things. Well, the outrageous in terms of things that I had done outrageous early in my career. One of the things, New England Cable News, this was Boston, but I was so determined to just, I just really wanted to be a journalist and I loved it and the experience of it. And I was on the early shift. So when you're on the early shift, it's like, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning.
Can't imagine.
It's
so wrong.
It's so brutal.
It's so wrong to wake up.
Just
when
think
it's dark,
about like half the, to look halfway decent at 6 in the morning, right? So it starts, you back time it quite a bit, mm-hmm. right? And so my shift, I was, you know, driving, and it was a drive home. And I got into a car accident. Mm-hmm. I was driving my parents' used family car. I think it was like a Chevy Nova, mm-hmm. and it was an 18-wheeler, and it like cut in front of me. And I was fine. I was absolutely fine. The car was destroyed, and the only thing I thought about at the time was how am I going to get to work tomorrow? Like that was the only thought, which mm-hmm. was crazy, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, what's the matter with you?
Exactly.
You know, something, you know, and I was like, how am I going to get to work? But I didn't have a lot of money. You know, I didn't barely had anything. And so I ended up going and taking a cab to work the next morning. Mm-hmm. And I told my boss what happened. And he was like, what the hell's the matter with you? You know, why didn't you go to the hospital? Are you okay?
Right.
Like, you know, all of those things that you would expect like a normal person to do and be. And, but I just told him, I have no transportation. I don't know what I'm going to do. I couldn't really afford to like rent a car for 2 weeks. And, you know, I had to find a car. And so my news director, allowed me to borrow the live truck, the satellite
That's
truck
funny.
Until I got a new car. Right.
Okay.
And so I drove off out of the station to my house in this huge live truck with the mast and the satellite dish, the whole thing. And it was crazy, right? Because I thought I was the baddest, coolest 20-something-year-old there was, because I would be at the grocery store and I'd back up and hear the beep, 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 beep. I'd be pulling up to the club and people are like, oh, what? Channel 4? What? You know, I'm like, no, it's just me and my live truck. You know, this huge, ridiculous, you know, vehicle. For 2 weeks, I did this until I was able to get my grandmother's car.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think that was a Lincoln something or another, big boat-like thing, to drive instead. But I can't imagine these days, right,
right,
that anything like that would ever fly, right? Can
yeah.
you imagine the lawsuits?
No.
Like, you gave this child what to drive?
Well, depending on who you gave it to. I mean, I have to say, I would be maybe tempted to like live broadcast from my
from my living room. Here I am. So that was pretty crazy.
Well, he gave the truck to the right person.
Oh,
you were very trustworthy, it seems.
Thank you. but that was nuts. And I think people don't even believe that story sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like they can't imagine the news director doing something that crazy.
Right.
You
right.
know.
Well, times were different.
Me.
I mean,
totally.
Yeah, there was
right?
a lot of like over litigation, and
it was just kind of making it happen.
Yes. Yes.
And it happened.
Right.
Yeah. It all worked out okay.
It all did. How about any bloopers on air?
First live shot was a disaster.
It was?
Yeah, total disaster. It was my first, very yeah. first. But, you know, they sent me out to, there was like a shooting. And I, my voice, I was trying really hard not to have my voice crack.
Because
I was
nervous,
really nervous. Okay. But my body betrayed me. And was shaking. I was shaking like a leaf, and you could see the microphone like dancing around in front of my face. It was horrible, right? And
right.
it was like, oh my God, what the hell's happening to her, right? I was really, really nervous, very nervous.
Sure.
And I was scared too that after that live shot, I was going to lose my job. I very much expected, right, that mm-hmm. they were going to say, you know, you're a little bit in over your head. This is ridiculous, right? So we went back to the station, and you know, to his credit, Charlie Kravitz, the news director. So I walked in, and I was like, my head's all bowed, oh my God, ashamed. He stood up and he started clapping. And he gave a standing ovation to me. And the rest of the newsroom had to, you know, they had to stand up and clap with him, right? The standing ovation. And I couldn't believe it, right? So I was like, oh my God, like, you know, this is amazing. The next day, it was breaking news, and he threw me right back out there.
Did he?
He threw me right back out there, and I'm so grateful that he did, because mm-hmm. it was like night and day. Mm-hmm. It was like the first day I had to get all of that out of my system, mm-hmm. out of my body, all the fear, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't have thought it was the same person.
Wow. What a great leader.
The second day, I was just calm and, like, composed, uh-huh. but he made sure... Right?
Yeah.
That he gave me an opportunity, mm-hmm. first round, gave mm-hmm. me a chance to screw up, mm-hmm. and then put me back out there.
Yeah. And supported you in a way that, hey, it's public and we're behind her, and go yes. out there tomorrow, Suzanne.
Yeah.
That's
so,
awesome.
So again, I don't know if they would do that today.
Yeah.
You know, the tolerance level for, like, error and grace it's pretty rough now. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of it too in the business is doing it, in the field, actually doing it, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
The kind of things that you can't learn in, you know, in school or even mm-hmm. a laboratory, you know, or even a mock setting. It's like, you really have to experience it.
Yeah.
And feel it.
Yeah. Especially if you're in the field, because you're live, you are dealing with a lot of uncontrollable elements. Yeah.
And one of the things that people ask a lot is like, well, you know, especially at the White House, do you get scared or nervous? You know, there's lots of people. And, you know, often I would just think of my mother mm-hmm. and my boss as being like the two primary people that were watching, because I knew they were, mm. right? My mom was always watching. Yeah, it was very sweet. She would call me after my live shots. Your pastor.
Stand up straight.
I'm like, Mom, did you hear anything? I was talking about the Iraq War. And she was like, your pastor. Yeah, I was like, oh my God. So there was my mom, who was the audience, who was like the everyday uh-huh. person, everyday viewer. And then it was my boss, who I knew. But early on at CNN, when I was at the White House, I had just started, and myself, and I was with this super young, mm-hmm. equally green producer, who was probably about 10 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. And it was the Columbia shuttle that was re-entering Earth's atmosphere that was coming. And it was the weekend, and it exploded, mm-hmm. and it didn't go well. And the two of us were just like, holy crap, what do we do? Mm-hmm. And we were getting calls frequently from our bosses. Oh, do you want us to call in Wolf Blitzer? Do you want John King to come? Mm-hmm. You know, we can call him. We can get them there. No, we got this, you know. So all day, you know, we just started getting information, mm-hmm. collecting our sources, asking the questions, doing the live shots, mm-hmm. you know, get the call again. Hey, are you sure are you okay? And like, yeah, we're okay. End of the day, we looked at each other and we're like, can you believe what just happened?
Right. When you have time to really process it while
yeah,
you're doing it.
Yeah. Because yes. you do have that sense of, you know, your nerves kick in.
Sure.
When you think about the gravity of the moment mm-hmm. or the importance of the moment, that can at some times, you know, freak you out a little, and you just have to, like, bring it back in and yeah. just think about, okay, I'm talking to my mother and my boss.
Right. Right. And I need to do this job for the rest of America to know the story.
Yeah.
Like, keeping your composure and
right.
saying the right things in really difficult situations.
Well, one of the things that I tell young people is, you know, the way that you are going to be a good reporter is you don't really think, the only thing you think about is what is the importance? Why am I here? Like, what is my mission? What is the one thing that I want my audience to know? Mm-hmm. That's the only reason you're there, and then tell them, right? Mm-hmm. And all the other stuff, like, oh my God, the hair, the makeup, the delivery, all that other stuff just kind of fades. Mm-hmm. It fades by the wayside, goes by the wayside. That will come.
Right.
But the thing that you must do is that you have to report the news, and you have to think about why you're out there, you know, mm-hmm. on the lawn of the White House or wherever you are. Mm-hmm. What is the one thing you really must convey to the viewers who are watching?
Right. And net that out and make sure you cover it and probably yeah. repeat it.
And that will cut through everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. So, you've covered some amazing stories and in war-torn countries, which is a perspective that not many people have had the opportunity to experience. So when you look back at your times at where you've covered stories in Rwanda, Ukraine, Afghanistan, what did you take away from those relative to, you know, resilience? And how did some of the stories that you covered in your mind make a difference?
Sure. I think that a lot of times, and I feel very fortunate every single day I walked, you know, through those gates to cover the White House, that I had that opportunity, because you are, you know, you're traveling the world, you're, you know, going to all these different countries, and you're covering, you know, holding your leaders accountable. And it really is a front row to history. It sounds like a cliche, but it's true. And I think that that's like the beauty of that kind of job, is that you learn every single day and you are a part of that learning process. The stories that have the most impact are the ones that you do over the course of time, and you have an opportunity to see a situation evolve. And so I'll give you an example of Rwanda. So Rwanda, I went to Rwanda 3 times. The first time was in 1998 with President Bill Clinton, and he apologized for the United States' lack of action regarding the genocide.
Okay.
He apologized in 1998 to the Rwandan people. It had been 4 years prior that the genocide had occurred. Mm-hmm. We were aboard Air Force One. We landed in Kigali, and we were at the airport on the tarmac for a total of 3 hours. Mm-hmm. It was deemed by the Secret Service it was not safe enough to leave the airport at mm-hmm. that time. And so everything was done on the tarmac. Mm-hmm. He made his announcement. He had his speech. I interviewed a genocide survivor, a young woman who had been gang raped, who had a scar, machete scar that was across her head. We were in two folding chairs, sitting across just like you and I here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was telling me about her story and surviving this genocide. And so I asked her, because I couldn't quite understand how she could be upright and be communicating with me, having gone through what she had gone through. Mm-hmm. And so I asked her, you know, what, you know, how do you survive? You know, what makes you capable of moving, of going day to day and just being a survivor? And she said, faith. Right? Faith. Mm-hmm. And so that resonated with me. That was the first trip. And I thought, wow, I took away that right. that message. Fast forward to 18 years later, I had another opportunity to go to Rwanda. It was the Nike Foundation had a program called the Girl Effect, mm-hmm. where the idea is you train, you help young women, girls, when they're just starting out in their careers, and you ultimately make the community and society much stronger mm. because you're empowering young women.
Nice.
And so it was journalism. It was journalists, young journalists, who I had an opportunity to meet. And they were, you know, like 18, 19 or whatever. I was working with them, and one of them, both of them had lost their parents in the genocide. She was 4 years old, and her little brother was 9 months old. And she had witnessed her parents being killed in front of her. She was raised by her grandmother. Mm-hmm. This was Antoinette. And she had a radio station. She was a DJ. Mm-hmm. She was a model. She was in this magazine.
Thriving.
It was Ninia Pinga, which mm-hmm. means in the local language, you know, girls striving to be strong and beautiful inside and out. Mm-hmm. So that was Antoinette. And then there was Dita, who was an actor. Mm-hmm. And she, too, lost her parents. She and her sister, as horrific as this sounds, they were thrown in a pit of dead bodies.
Oh my God.
And there was a neighbor who basically bought their freedom, mm-hmm. you know, paid for them to be removed. Right. Mm-hmm. So this was during the genocide where the Hutu killed, I think it was 800,000 Tutsi
right.
in 100 days.
Oh my God.
This was 1994. Mm-hmm. So this is the aftermath of all of that. And these are these young women who are thriving.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about resilience. So you fast forward to the third time, that I was in Rwanda, which was just a couple of years ago, and I made a point to go back and find them.
Oh, wow.
These two young journalists, mm-hmm. right, to see how they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so Antoinette, unfortunately, there were opportunities that were no longer there that had existed. Mm-hmm. So the radio station had shut down, the magazine was gone. Mm-hmm. So Antoinette, she was basically raising her brother. Her brother okay. lived with her, who was having drug issues. Mm-hmm. She had a son who was the same age as my daughter, 10. Mm-hmm. And so she was struggling. She was looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was hard to find work, hard to find employment.
Right.
That was her story.
Economy had changed.
That was her update.
Okay.
Dita, on the other hand, the actor, she was thriving because she had an investment person who invested in her. And so she had this thriving coffee shop and theater.
Okay.
A studio. And so she was actually doing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
But to reunite with both of them, you know,
yeah,
like
20 years later.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Wow.
It was just like, it was like, whoa. So that's resilience, right?
Yes.
And you can see that's resilience. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if I have time, but I have another story.
Yeah, you definitely
Rwanda.
Have time.
Okay,
yes.
Good. So I want to, there's another story that I took away from Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was there, same time I met these two young journalists,
mm-hmm.
I went to a reconciliation camp.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a government-operated place, about 53 homes, where you had, it's a, kind of like in the model of South Africa,
okay.
right? Reconciliation process, where you have the Hutu and the Tutsi, the two different ethnic groups who experienced this genocide, living in the same community.
Wow.
Because it really was neighbor against neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, it took off, and it happened very quickly, and it was just very brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Frederick. He was the Hutu who participated in killing the family of Laura, who was Tutsi, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he went to jail mm-hmm. for 9 years. And then he also was part of this process of asking for forgiveness of Laura and her family, right? Because this is how the country is to
itself.
Heal, right?
Right?
That was the idea,
okay.
right? So they build homes together.
Mm-hmm.
They work together. They live side by side, just as they had as young children
mm-hmm.
before one neighbor turned against the other neighbor.
Right.
Right. And so I sat with both of them, and I again, couldn't quite understand how it was even possible, right, for them to be in the same place. But Frederick, I asked him, you know, how on earth and why did this happen? And he said he was brainwashed by the government, and that he believed that his neighbor, who was, you know, sitting right next to him, was, you know, inhuman, right? And had to be killed, right? This was like the thing that was happening. And I asked Laura, you know, had she forgiven him, right? And she said, well, she saw him at first as like the devil, and she couldn't really even comprehend or understand how her neighbor had done such a thing. And she said they prayed together for 3 months, and she eventually felt like she had forgiven him. And so they had, you know, built these houses together, lived in the community. Okay, so my journalism skepticism, when I went back, right,
mm-hmm.
11 years later, I was like, okay, I'm going to find these two,
right?
Right? Did this
going on.
Grand experiment work?
Mm-hmm.
Is this even possible? Or was this just some sort of like, oh.
Propaganda.
Exactly.
Government propaganda.
Exactly, right? Or, you know, a, mm-hmm. a good idea that, you know, never really materialized.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back, and this is just a couple of years ago. This was an opportunity I had through the Aspen Institute.
Mm-hmm.
They went to Rwanda. I went with them. But with the additional goal of finding these two.
Right.
And sure enough, I found the Reconciliation Village. I was shocked.
Mm-hmm.
It was still there. It existed. I found these two individuals, Frederick and Laura. I got them side by side, across from each other once again. Right. Now, they were in their mid-40s and had children when I first met them. They were in their mid-50s, right, just a couple of years ago. So Frederick's laughing about how he lost all his hair, right? He's bald. And Laura is joking about how she's gained all this weight, right? Like we're all like just middle-aged people kind of like making a joke, right? Like, oh, look at us now, you know?
Living somewhat normal lives.
But right? It was amazing because
where they came from.
I did ask them again. I was like, so tell me about this, you know, how is it going? Mm-hmm. And sure enough, he has been, Frederick, he has been helping kind of raise, you know, her children, support her children financially. They go to the same church. They are a community again. Mm-hmm. She has learned in real ways, you know, to accept his labor, if you will, of forgiveness or for forgiveness and live with him in this community. And they still live together in this community with other families.
It's amazing.
That was a lesson. And that was a demonstration of forgiveness.
Right.
That was so profound for me because I think about my own stuff and I'm like, well, nothing comes in anywhere close to what we're talking about here, right? Could I? And so it challenged me to think about that notion of forgiveness. And if these two, mm-hmm. right, under these horrific conditions and situation can do that for one another or for their lives or for their well-being, you know, what can we do, right? Could we, you know, and as a country, right, as a community, even, you know, our families,
absolutely,
on whatever level we find ourselves being challenged in that way.
Yeah, it puts everything in perspective when you think about it that way. And I am always stunned and grateful and also hope that I would be that person if something happened where a family member of mine was murdered. Would never want to see that. But there are so many people who just say, I have to forgive them because that's what God wants me to do. I want to live a better life. And it, I don't want that burden on my soul. I want to be a light in the world. And to do that, you have to forgive.
Yes. And Laura said herself, she said that, you know, the forgiveness job, that's ultimately up to God. Mm-hmm. So that's not really my job. So I'm going to, you know, do the best that I can do as, you know, as in her life, mm-hmm. in her circumstance.
Wow. So that, and there's 53 houses. Is that in just one community? Or
it's one community.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And I went back to that community. Mm-hmm. So there is something about when you are able, when you have that ability to go back and see the evolution, mm-hmm. of a society or of a story, I think that's the opportunity where you really can learn.
Right.
Right, about humanity and our common humanity.
Yeah, definitely a deeper level understanding too. It's another chapter in the story.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, this has been wonderful. We have so much more to talk about. I think now let's take a little break, and then we're going to come back and talk about the five presidents, or maybe a few of them that you've interviewed.
Okay. All right. I love it.
Thanks, Suzanne.
Thank you for listening. Our hope is to spark a little joy, inspire, and educate our listeners in ways to live an even more meaningful life. If you have reactions to share from what you've heard, please visit our website, refirement.life, to leave a voice message. You may even be featured in a future episode. To keep in touch, subscribe to our podcast, Refirement Life, using the podcast player of your choice. Always remember, you are never too old to set a new goal or to dream a new dream. Thanks again for joining us on this episode. Until next time.